because in supplement form, it's often used as a sleep aid and for good reason. As a supplement, it helps get our body clocks adjusted to sleep better. We can also find natural ways to make our sleep pattern more predictable. One way is through meditation. Meditation seems to cause the release of melatonin to soothe your body and protect your own tissue-friendly stem cells. It makes the only tossing and turning in bed you ever do the va-va-vroom kind. So now you know why our sleep action plan, that's not an oxymoron, includes meditation before bed. Night plight, your need for sleep. The evidence is clear that a good night's sleep is fundamental to both your health and your longevity. But what exactly is a good night's sleep? While the length of sleep is important, equally vital is getting through the sleep cycle several times. The cycle comprises the following stages. Sleep latency. This is the time it takes for you to fall asleep from the time you go to bed. Stages 1 and 2, light sleep. Drowsiness is your brain is just getting into sleep. In stage 2, your brain waves start to slow down noticeably, resting those parts you use while awake. Stages 3 and 4, deeper sleep, which you get less of as you age because of frequent awakenings. These stages are both restorative. Both REM sleep and sleep stages 3 and 4 are homeostatically driven. That is, if a human is selectively deprived of one of these, it rebounds once the person is allowed to sleep. This suggests that both are essential in the sleep process and its many functions. REM, rapid eye movement, the deepest sleep. Your eyes are moving fast, but the rest of your body is paralyzed. It's the stage where some sleep-related disorders take place, like sleepwalking. Each one of these cycles lasts about 90 minutes, and you go through 4 to 6 of them a night. But the important part is you have to get to REM sleep to feel rested. People who have sleep problems often don't make it to REM sleep because it takes up to 60 minutes to make it to REM. If you're having frequent awakenings before you make it to REM, then you're never getting that restorative, healthy sleep. Now, complex changes occur in your body and mind as you awaken. Your melatonin levels have peaked, the stress hormone cortisol is on the rise, your body temperature has bottomed out, and your psyche is immersed in your dreams. Increased levels of melatonin associated with deep sleep promote immune system activity, protect you from viruses, and have remarkable anti-cancer properties. Deep sleep also increases human growth hormone naturally, so the levels oscillate as they're supposed to, and you start to feel like a puppy. Growth hormone also plays a critical role in fostering optimal body weight. Sleep problems that develop with age can be attributed to a decrease in REM caused by frequent awakenings. Why does this happen? Historically, a lack of sleep served as a warning signal of sorts. Insomnia actually helped us survive. We're restless when something's on our mind like a predator. Today, that lack of sleep, harmful to your health and generally unnecessary as a protective mechanism, serves as a different kind of warning signal, that you're experiencing some kind of bodily system malfunction. While there are literally dozens of clinically diagnosed sleep disorders, we'll concentrate on the ones that are most disruptive. Insomnia. Insomnia is defined as either not being able to get to sleep in the first place or not being able to get back to sleep after waking up. Unbelievably, people over the age of 65 have an average of 25 awakenings a night, and that number increases with age. And one-third of all of us wake up repeatedly during the night, while a quarter of us wake up early in the morning and can't get back to sleep. The big problem for most of us is an increase in sleep latency as you worry about your job, bills, and why Junior came home with a purple mohawk. The likely chemical culprit in insomnia, melatonin. Normally, melatonin levels rise about 2 hours before bedtime and peak when your body temperature is the lowest to help induce sleep. But without adequate melatonin, your body is unable to transition from sleep latency to stage one. Sleep apnea. You know it as the honey shut up disease. While we often associate sleep apnea with snoring, the truth is sleep apnea is actually signaled by silence, often preceded or followed by power tool sounds, when you're not breathing for up to 10 seconds at a time. And that's what actually rustles you awake. You can have as many as 200 episodes a night, though it's more typical to have about 5 episodes an hour. They act like a series of rear-end collisions. One might not necessarily be damaging, but time after time after time, eventually you're going to damage your infrastructure. In fact, sleep apnea leads to hypertension, heart trouble, lack of energy, and a decrease in the all-important growth hormone. What's the primary cause of it? Fat. Those with a neck size larger than 17 inches are at greatly increased risk. When your heavy jaw naturally moves backward when you're sleeping, it meets the fatty tissue in the back of your mouth in your throat area. That's what blocks the airway and stops air from getting into your lungs. At the risk of sounding like a broken MP3 file, we'll repeat. Of all the strategies we've outlined in this audiobook, getting the right sleep is one of the most vital things you can do. Sleep should serve as a major health barometer. Not only does a lack of sleep cause health problems, but health problems also cause a lack of sleep. Plus, we need sleep so we can dream. You can't live your best life unless you can dream. So if you're not sleeping, it's a clue that something besides your sheets isn't working the way it should be.
U-tips. As everyone with sleep problems knows, sleep is about as easy as making the final 12 in American Idol. We believe that's because many of us don't know the tricks and solutions that can help put our mind and body at rest. U-tip, plan for it. We're big on planning, so decide when you want to wake up and count backward for about 7 hours. Now take about a 15-minute period before that to start your slowdown process. That means taking 5 minutes to finish up must-do chores, followed by 5 minutes of hygiene stuff, and 5 minutes of relaxing into your sleep state through things like meditation and saying, I love you, as you lie in bed. U-tip, use the night. Most of us do things at night that are counterproductive to sleeping. Instead, make slight changes in your ritual to prepare your body for rest. Dim your lights several hours before bed to avoid the stimulation caused by artificial light pollution, which is all around us through television and computers and indoor lighting and serves to stimulate us. Come up with a regular, rhythmic evening ritual that allows you to embrace anxieties that are released when you slow down. Meditation, prayer, and deep breathing are all good methods. Surrender to sleep. There's nothing you have to do to sleep, except let go of waking. Practice dying into sleep, rather than forcing yourself to sleep, and cultivate awareness of your personal twilight zone. U-tip, attack insomnia. Tossing and turning works for salads, not sleep problems. If you can't fall asleep within 15 minutes, the answer is not to keep trying. Don't force yourself to stay in bed because the wait will be interminable. Instead, get out of bed and do some light activity. Try a yoga pose, meditation, or a short walk. To get back to sleep, music and meditation seem to work best. U-tip, know the no's. Generally, we don't like telling you not to do something unless it's smoking, slurping trans fats, or spending 16 hours in front of the tube. But for optimum sleep preparation, there are a few things you should avoid to increase your chance of falling and staying asleep. No alcohol or nicotine for 1.5 hours before bed. No exercise that makes you sweat for 1.5 hours before bed. By the way, doing things that make you sweat in bed are okay. No caffeine, caffeinated beverages or food, or caffeine in pills for at least 3 hours before bed or as long as your body dictates. No eating for 3 hours before bed so you can avoid reflux issues that can disturb sleep. U-tip, find your pain. Some sleep problems don't arise because of worry or melatonin problems. Some are caused because your back hurts like the dickens. Truth is, some people get through general back pain or knee pain during the day because they're so focused on other things. But when trying to get to sleep, they feel the pain and focus on it. A simple over-the-counter anti-inflammatory medication can help, not specifically to get you to sleep, but to help alleviate the pain that's preventing you from sleeping. Take aspirin with a glass of water at least 1 hour before bedtime so that the acid doesn't have as much of a chance of refluxing up from your stomach to your esophagus. U-tip, treat allergies. Allergies can make sleeping trouble worse because of the congestion they cause. About 40% of people with allergic rhinitis have trouble sleeping. Over-the-counter nasal strips and sprays help open up everything and clear up symptoms like headaches, watery eyes, runny nose, or new-onset snoring. If you experience those symptoms and aren't aware of any allergies, search for the source in unexpected places. Some people have allergies to gluten, which are wheat, barley, and oats, and they can lead to congestion and increased insomnia, as can allergies to detergents and the cleaning products you use on your clothes and sheets. One note, decongestant nasal sprays are addictive and they raise your blood pressure. Saline or antihistamine sprays or a prescription steroid spray are better options. U-tip, consider herbals. Several supplements have been shown to decrease sleep problems. These are the ones we recommend. Valerian root. It contains ingredients with sedative properties and is generally considered one of the more effective herbal therapies for sleep. Our recommendation, 300 milligrams. Ginseng. Studies have shown that the ingredients in ginseng help decrease the amount of wakefulness in a 12-hour period and increase the amount of slow-wave sleep. Try 200 to 600 milligrams of the extract.
Major ager, wacky hormones. The natural fluctuations in hormone levels aren't all bad. Unlike a bone that can break, or blood that can clot, or even a neuron that can occasionally fail to fire to give you the numbers of your combination lock, hormones are enigmatic and intangible. But that doesn't mean that your hormones are less important than any other system in your body, or that you should simply accept hormonal decline as a fact of aging. From an evolutionary perspective, hormones may be considered the most important system in your body. Testosterone and estrogen, the major sex hormones in men and women respectively, give us the urge and ability to try to reproduce and continue the survival of the species. Biologically, it don't get bigger than that. We need adequate, not necessarily high, levels of sex hormones to complete the equation of male plus female equals the next generation of the tribe. But once we're past our reproductive prime, our hormone levels drop. Men lose their testosterone, while women lose their estrogen and experience menopause. The tangible outcome? Lack of sex drive, insomnia, impotence, weight gain, and countless other potential health problems that can chip away at the quality of your life. But instead of cursing our hormones for not having the stamina to keep up with our lives, what we ought to do is figure out why our hormone levels dip and drop. Thinking about that reason from an anthropological perspective will help us not think about aging as inevitably bad, but rather as inevitably, well, inevitable. That's the way nature is supposed to work. Try considering your waning hormone levels as a way to benefit society. Men needed testosterone to give them the strength and guts to fight for land, to compete against warring tribes, to woo mates, and to protect the offspring that resulted. But as they grew older, they didn't need the reproductive effects of testosterone because the next generation was already in place. And here's where it gets interesting. They also didn't need testosterone's aggressive effect. If mature tribesmen spent all their time fighting neighboring tribes, they jeopardized their own survival and wouldn't live long enough to help the community in another way, through mentoring, through passing along wisdom, through helping to develop the intellect of future generations. In essence, that hormone surge in our youth and the hormone drop as we age isn't bad per se. It's actually quite advantageous. Similarly, from an anthropological perspective, women stop ovulating and the levels of hormone needed for it drop so they can graduate from making babies to nurturing the entire community. If you look at brain scans, postmenopausal women think more like men and play a more dominant role in society because they're not dealing with the hormonal and physical challenges of being fertile, like PMS and pregnancy. Yeah, we know what you're saying. All your little tribesmen stories might make good fodder for a campfire and med school reunions, but what the heck are you going to do about my hot flashes, Doc? We hear you. We're not saying that you need to just accept a drop in hormone levels and an increase in life-altering side effects. What we want you to do is acknowledge the fact that aging occurs for a reason, and that reason may actually be good for society. When it comes to your hormones, the problems happen when they fluctuate too much or decrease. If that happens, then yes, you are going to experience side effects that no anthropological yarn is ever going to quell. Still, some of the most intriguing and enticing hormonal treatments dealing with vitality, things such as DHEA and growth hormone, offer some promise in terms of treatment. Ultimately, we want you to make sure your hormonal and related systems are in good working order, no matter what your age.
Chapter 10. Make the most of menopause. Nobody would disagree that today's medical world is pretty darn advanced. We can replace bad hearts with good ones, we can make artificial limbs and ligaments, we can prevent seasickness and the flu, and we can do everything from scan the innermost parts of your body to cosmetically alter the outermost. But one of the many things we haven't been able to do, yet, is get a real handle on your hormones. It's not that we haven't tried. Ever since the scientific world realized that men's and women's lives were being adversely affected by dropping estrogen and testosterone levels, the question has been clear. Can we safely and effectively replace hormone levels so that you can live young at any age? In this chapter, we'll discuss how hormonal and sexual issues are major ages for women. That's because declining estrogen is associated not only with such life draggers as hot flashes and insomnia, but with sexuality, a key quality of life issue. When your hormones drop, sexual problems like loss of libido and lubrication arise. For the record, many other things can cause a drop in libido, including stress, financial problems, gain in waist size, and partners who are about as romantic as paperclips. The treatment of symptoms related to estrogen decline has been controversial and confusing, and for good reason. This hormone replacement story has all the drama of a classic medical mystery, complete with conflicting evidence. Anti-aging docs who vehemently defend hormone therapy, and other docs who think it's the worst thing since sliced buttered bread made with refined flour. Here, we'll clear up some of the confusion so you can decide whether restoring your hormones is right for you, and we'll tell you what we recommend to our families and patients. The three-headed hormone, why estrogen is so powerful. A lot of us like to fling around the word estrogen, the way a pizza maker flings around dough. But the truth is that estrogen is a lot more complicated than that. With regard to HRT, or hormone replacement therapy, which by the way is now called hormone therapy, or HT, there are three important estrogen pathways to consider. In each case, the hormone works by locking onto a specific estrogen receptor in the body. We'll name them 1, 2, and 3 for simplicity. Estrogen receptor number 1 is located in the breast and uterine tissue. It's associated with female traits such as breast growth and menstruation. Estrogen that attaches to receptor number 1 is thought to be linked to certain cancers because it promotes growth of breast and uterine tissue. Estrogen receptor number 2 is linked to the cardiovascular system, and estrogen's apparent protective effect on the heart and arteries. Estrogen receptor number 3 is linked to the bones, allowing estrogen to strengthen bones. These three receptors make estrogen therapy tricky. You get benefits by increasing the levels of estrogens that bind to receptors numbers 2 and 3, but risks when too much estrogen binds to receptor 1. That's why we're seeing, and will be seeing, an increase in so-called designer estrogens. These are estrogens that protect the heart and bones and diminish menopausal symptoms without increasing cancer risk. These designer estrogens, like Evista, may prove to be one of the most promising developments in medicine because of their potential to give you what you really want when it comes to hormone therapy. The rewards without the risks. As of now, it seems that Evista does not treat menopausal symptoms and does not provide cardioprotection, but it does protect bones and reduce the frequency of some breast cancers. The risks and rewards of estrogen therapy. The reason why hormone therapy is controversial is this. These early studies of women who replace estrogen were epidemiological. In other words, they were just collections of information on everyone who could be found. These studies compared postmenopausal women who did and did not take estrogen, but there was no attempt to select by a randomized process who took the estrogen and who didn't. It was just a side-by-side comparison. These epidemiological and not random studies showed that women taking estrogen had a dramatic decrease in heart attacks and ischemic strokes compared to those women who weren't taking hormone therapy. By the way, it wasn't just a little decrease. It was up to a 75% decrease. And the women who took estrogen also had higher healthy or HDL cholesterol, increased bone strength, and substantially decreased menopausal symptoms. Hot flashes, mood swings, and insomnia practically disappeared. These early studies made estrogen seem truly beneficial. But with time, women on estrogen replacement also suffered a buildup of uterine tissue that led to an increase in uterine cancer, as well as a proliferation of breast tissue associated with an increase in breast cancer. To reduce the risk of uterine cancer, a cyclical dose of a specific progestin, which is non-bioidentical synthetic progesterone, was added to the estrogen. The progestin caused the excess estrogen-stimulated uterine tissue to slough off. Continued menstruation, by the way, was a side effect associated with this reduction of cancer risk. Now we know that only women who have undergone hysterectomies should consider taking unopposed estrogen. By the way, obese women have an increased risk of uterine cancer because body fat is a significant source of peripheral estrogen storage. Eventually, randomized studies were done to assess the effects of estrogen on arterial aging, preventing strokes, heart attacks, and memory loss. The largest and most publicized was the Women's Health Initiative. To many people's surprise, the study showed an increase in heart attacks and strokes soon after starting therapy, mainly, in our opinion, because the estrogen and progestin had a clotting effect in leg veins and critical arteries. However, it turned out that there were problems with the studies. First, nobody was prescribed 162 milligrams of aspirin to reduce the clotting effect. Second, the progestin studied in the Women's Health Initiative was one that had been shown subsequently to counter estrogen's positive cardiovascular effects. And third, the studies enrolled women who had not previously used hormone therapy, were usually more than 15 years post-menopause, and had no symptoms that warranted starting treatment. Women with significant menopausal symptoms were actually excluded from the studies. In recent years, HT formulations have evolved and can now be obtained with new substances, which we'll explain in a moment, and in much lower doses than previously available. So they're safer and better tolerated, though they still have some side effects. Our stance when it comes to all of this? If you're one of the 25% of women who are not miserable during menopause, don't complicate your life with pills. However, if you're one of the 25% of women whose hot flashes have given you a misdemeanor rap from threatening to tap fire hydrants, then don't fear putting HT on your radar screen. And what about the remaining 50% who are hot and bothered, but could get through with some of the supportive approaches we describe later in this chapter? Even in our own families, we are split. But we agree that hormone therapy with aspirin and a micronized, not conjugated, progestin is not psychotic, because the potential benefits might outweigh the potential risks. Most physicians remain appropriately skeptical and will likely avoid recommending HT therapy to you until we have more studies. But when the dust settles in 20 or so years, we believe that women who use HT in the form of bioidentical estrogen and micronized progestin, along with aspirin to reduce clotting risks, will experience a prolonged, higher quality of life, including a decrease in heart disease, arterial aging, and memory loss, and an increase in bone strength. The downside? We'll see a slight increase in breast cancer. That's because estrogen helps estrogen-sensitive breast tissue grow. Keep this in mind as you and your doctor decide if the potential benefits that address your personal concerns outweigh the potential risks, considering your personal risk factors and family history.
U-tips. While there are several things you can do to increase your estrogen naturally, those strategies, say exercising or deep breathing, aren't the big guns when it comes to preventing and reducing the symptoms of menopause. Hormone therapy is by far the most effective solution, but the decision to go on HT must be made on an individual basis. Figure out whether it's a good fit for you. U-tip, educate yourself on replacements. If you've done any research about replacement therapy, you've probably noticed that there seems to be as many hormonal compounds as there are corner coffee shops. And the reality, as you've likely guessed, is that some of them are not all that effective. Some you get from the pharmacy, some you get from the health food store, and some you might as well be getting from a street vendor wearing a trench coat. As with anything you're going to inject, swallow, or rub on your body, you have to be aware of what you're using. Here are some definitions for you. Micronized progesterone. To allow absorption of progesterone from pills, it has to be protected from digestion by the acid and enzymes of the stomach and early intestine. Originally, an acetate group was attached to protect the progesterone. Unfortunately, the acetate group also seemed to change some of the beneficial effects of the progesterone. So a newer technique, putting the progesterone in mini capsules called micronized progesterone, was developed. You get the benefits of the progesterone without the side effects of the acetate protection. Bioidentical compounds. These chemically synthesized or natural molecules of estrogen and progestin are most like the ones in your body. They are mixed and matched by compounding pharmacies or by pharmaceutical firms. This term has been hijacked by some who use only products from compounding pharmacies, but in truth, there are natural compounds made to the more rigorous quality control standards of big pharma. Natural compounds. Herbal supplements like soy and yam contain plant hormones that may resemble your hormones, according to those who market them. There are a lot of natural compounds, such as estrogen from pregnant mare's urine, but for this chapter, we're using the phrase natural compounds to indicate only over-the-counter herbal supplements. U-tip, choose your option. Hormone therapy comes in a variety of delivery methods, including pills, patches, gels, vaginal creams, and combinations of the above. In the cycle method, where you still get a monthly period, you take estrogen continuously for 3 weeks a month and add progestin for 12 days of the month. Newer preparations are available that cycle every 3 months or even every 2 years, so you have less frequent periods. With continuous dosing, you take both hormones daily, often in one combined pill. Irregular bleeding is common when starting this and indicates not quite enough hormone. This may seem unnatural, but remember that due to constant pregnancy and breastfeeding, our female ancestors had only about 100 menses in their lifetimes. Many women today will have 350 menses, so reducing the monthly event might even be more natural than we suspect. In theory, this would also reduce the incidence of cancer of the reproductive organs. Women who prefer not to take pills can apply patches to their thighs or abdomen or use an estrogen gel or cream. Some patches contain estrogen and progestin, but many patches as well as gels and cream are estrogen only, and you will need additional progesterone pills to protect your uterus. Compounded bioidenticals are usually delivered in a cream. Some data show that gels and creams are safer and give benefits, but the research isn't solid enough to insist on this approach to our family members. Whatever delivery method, it's best to try something that lives for a short time in your body so that if you have negative side effects, you can stop or lessen your dose. One benefit of using a compounded product is that you can really control the dosing by starting low and moving up. Shots and implants, by contrast, aren't great to start with because once they're in your system, they can't be taken out until the cycle has ended. U-tip, make a plan. How do you know which kind of HT to take? Well, the drug used in the Women's Health Initiative was Prempro, a combination of conjugated equine estrogen, Premarin from pregnant mare's urine, and a methyl progesterone acetate, medroxyprogesterone, formally. This latter progesterone choice proved unfortunate because it turned out in test tube studies to antagonize the benefits of the estrogen on arterial health. That's why we recommend a pharmaceutical-grade synthetic bioidentical estrogen. For the progesterone component, we recommend a micronized pill like Prometrium. Prometrium is in a peanut oil base, so don't try this if you or a family member has a peanut allergy. If you have an allergy to peanuts, ask your doc to prescribe an alternative progesterone that is not conjugated and not peanut-based. Most experts agree that your goal should be on the lowest possible dose for the shortest period of time. Blood tests are not very good at predicting estrogen's effectiveness on a cellular level, because hormone levels can fluctuate as a woman approaches menopause, we focus on symptoms more than blood tests to determine what and how much to prescribe. Here are the specifics. For women with significant quality of life menopausal symptoms who want to consider hormone therapy, the first thing to do after you and your physician have agreed on this plan is to start taking 162 milligrams of aspirin a day at least 2 days before taking the hormones. For a woman near 50 with a uterus and menopausal symptoms starting to disturb her life, we recommend an estradiol, usually beta estradiol, many generic preparations are available, in a small dose of about 0.3 milligrams. Use the smallest amount that controls your symptoms. Increase in 0.25 milligram amounts every 10 days until your symptoms are controlled. The equivalent for patches is a 0.025 milligrams patch each day. Add a micronized progestin, Prometrium at 100 milligrams or occasionally 200 milligrams for 12 days a month. We like to use Angelique, which combines estradiol with Prometrium and can be used continuously for women who don't want periods. If you wish to use a patch for estrogen, you need cream or the Prometrium pill alone for the progestin. We think it is completely reasonable to keep this program going for its anti-aging benefits while your symptoms last, and perhaps for up to 10 years. U-tip. Fix the flash. Most hot flashes will resolve in 3 to 5 years. While we don't think you necessarily have to, quote, deal with it, end quote, we also know that if the symptoms are minor enough, you can use non-hormonal therapy techniques to try and help control them. Estrogen is about 90% effective in reducing hot flashes, but other methods may also help. Why? If you can control your central thermostat and relax your arteries, you can avoid that roller coaster of vascular constriction and dilation that causes the sweats. That's why things like meditation and relaxation techniques may be helpful for reducing the red heat. Deep breathing, which helps counteract the major ager of a lack of nitric oxide, is more effective than any other therapy except estrogen. Yoga incorporates belly breathing and also offers poses that could help to lower blood pressure and heart rate. Vitamin E is anecdotally helpful, and if you are desperate, why not? U-tips, avoid your trigger. You remember the first time you suffered hot flashes? Now remember what started the symptoms. That is one of your triggers. Common culprits include stress, red wine, chocolate, coffee, and hot rooms, although it's hard to tell after the flash has started. Chapter 11, Protect Your Privates. Here's the thing. While you may feel embarrassed to talk about urine spots on your shorts or the fact that you've lost some propulsion in your ejaculation, not that you're looking, prostate problems affect lots of men, frankly, the majority of men, if they live long enough, making it the hormonal equivalent to female menopause. So let's take a look and see how the prostate can malfunction and what you can do to keep it healthy. Rubber glove, please. Your prostate, go with the flow. With the exception of yoga teachers, most of us don't have that good a view of the prostate. Resting below the bladder and in front of the rectum, the prostate is around the size of a walnut. The seminal vesicles, the ducts that shuttle semen for foreign exploration, are attached to the prostate and intersect with the urethra to take urine from the bladder. Unlike most other organs, the prostate grows with aging. How? The major ager of wacky hormones send to the prostate its representative, testosterone, which is the active steroid in non-sexual tissue like muscle. Testosterone is converted to dihydrotestosterone, DHT, the active steroid hormone in sexual tissue. DHT causes the prostate to grow. That's called hypertrophy. But just as in urban planning, growth isn't necessarily bad as long as you keep it under control and have the infrastructure to handle it. What's important is to determine why the prostate is growing as you age and whether or not that growth is due to something that will kill you, change your quality of life, or do neither. Here are the major things that can change your walnut-sized gland into more of a coconut-sized one, or at least make it feel that way. Prostatitis, an inflammation of the prostate. Prostatitis is often caused by bacteria. Though some men don't have any symptoms, even if they do have the condition, those who do can experience leg-crossing pelvic pain. The reason? The inflamed prostate swells and squeezes the urethra, causing pain. That squeeze also means that you may experience urinary problems, such as feeling the way you would if you had 4 beers in 45 minutes. Gotta go right now. Just as gingivitis can be an indicator of general inflammation throughout the body, prostatitis is a sign that you may have dangerous inflammation throughout your body. Benign prostatic hypertrophy, BPH, occurring in the inner part of the prostate gland called the periurethral gland, BPH is non-cancerous growth that happens with age and only if you have testicles. It's a very common condition, with 50% of men getting it by the age of 60 and 9 out of 10 men having it by the age of 85. This very slow and progressive growth of the prostate happens when you experience a decrease in nitric oxide and an increase in oxidative stress, which can be caused by chronic infection and nutritional deficiencies. The symptoms can be similar to those of prostatitis. You feel as if you always have to go to the bathroom. You feel an incomplete emptying of your bladder, and you may feel burning when you urinate. Because you have an incomplete emptying of your bladder, you may dribble like a Harlem Globetrotter. And you may have to get up at night to pee more frequently than an on-call intern stops for coffee. Contrary to popular belief, these symptoms don't increase your risk of getting the next condition. Prostate cancer. Usually found in the outer zone of the prostate, prostate cancer tends to be thought of as an all-or-nothing situation. Either you remove the prostate or you die. What we want you to know is this. Not all prostate cancer needs to be treated aggressively with surgery. Certainly, prostate cancer needs to be followed more closely than a high-speed fugitive, but you should make treatment decisions taking into consideration such things as life expectancy, quality of life, potential side effects of treatment, and aggressiveness of the cancer. Docs will use what's called a Gleason score to determine how aggressive the cells of the cancer are. The primary way to measure prostate health, along with the digital rectal exam, is through a prostate-specific antigen blood test. That's called a PSA. This test measures the inflammation in the prostate. Contrary to popular belief, a high score doesn't automatically mean you have cancer. It simply means that your prostate is enlarged for some reason, be it cancer or something else. More importantly than learning the actual number is monitoring your change from year to year or every 6 months if the number is high, so you can see whether growth and inflammation are gradual or shoot up like a hot stock. A normal increase is less than 30% per year. That's why we recommend an annual PSA test for men starting at age 35 or 40. A PSA test is not a substitute for a rectal exam, as at least 20% of cancers don't involve elevated PSAs. So you need both the exam and the PSA to make the best starting point diagnoses. Like testosterone, your PSA test should measure free and bound PSA. The lower the free PSA, the more likelihood there is to be cancer. Usually less than 15% free means you should have a biopsy. The reason? Cancer cells make compounds that enhance the binding of PSA, making the number an important clue if the PSA is in the borderline range of 4 to 10. Here's where the level should be, remembering that an increase over time is more indicative than just a single test. Age 40 to 49, a PSA level of 0 to 2.5. Age 50 to 59, a PSA level of 0 to 3.5. Age 60 to 69, a PSA level of 0 to 4.5. Age 70 to 79, a PSA level of 0 to 6.5. Treatment options. Various medical procedures exist for treating benign diseases such as BPH, as well as cancer if you decide that the discomfort of your symptoms or the rate of cancer's growth outweighs the risk associated with losing your prostate. In some cases, surgery may be preferable to taking drugs for the rest of your life. In fact, 30% of men will eventually undergo some type of prostate surgery. Following are the procedure options, but it's a fast-changing field, so you should talk to your doc about all available options. For cancer, radical prostatectomy. In this procedure, the gland and surrounding tissues are removed. It can cure the cancer as long as the cancer has not spread beyond the prostate. Losing the prostate also means you'll lose some bladder control, at least temporarily. One good option, nerve-sparing radical retropubic prostatectomy, so you'd be more likely to have erections. Minimally invasive, laparoscopic, or robotic laparoscopic nerve-sparing radical prostatectomy are variations. Radiation. Radiation and radioactive seeds, which irradiate and kill cancer cells and tissues surrounding the seeds, are non-surgical options. We favor the nerve-sparing radical retropubic prostatectomy by an experienced surgical team if you are under 60 or expect to live at least 30 years, and directed beam radiation if you expect to live fewer than 20 years. For benign prostatic hypertrophy, transurethral procedures. various procedures such as laser prostatectomy, microwave prostatectomy, and electrovaporization can remove some of the inside tissue of the prostate using various technologies to relieve inflammation and reduce symptoms associated with BPH. There are even battles between what color light the laser should be. In general, these procedures are outpatient, simple procedures, and your urologist can help you choose the one that will best alleviate your symptoms. Downside, these procedures may need to be repeated, and in case you haven't translated transurethral yet, then realize that an instrument's got to go inside a hole that's usually used to letting urine out.
U-tips. While a number of things have been shown to prevent prostate-related diseases, understanding the various treatments and interpretations of prostate problems is especially important. You may not prevent the growth, but you can prevent the growth from shutting you down. U-tip. Stay relative. As we mentioned earlier, don't go into a full freak-out mode if your PSA score seems high. You have to put it in the context of your previous scores. Likewise, realize that different laboratory kits give different results. So if you change doctors, an increase or decrease could be a result of the lab, not actual changes in your prostate. And that means you'll have to establish a new baseline when a new lab is used. U-tip, veg out. A number of nutrients have been shown to improve prostate health, such as green tea and pomegranates. In a study of men who refused prostate surgery, one group of men only did watchful waiting, which is having a doc observe a patient but not intervene unless requested, while the other group went on an aggressive plant-based diet and stress reduction program. Their diet was low in fat and rich in selenium, lycopene, and vitamin E. The outcome? The latter group reduced their PSA levels by 40%, and none went on to surgery in a 2-year period. Many in the control group required an operation, and their PSA levels remained elevated. After being on the healthy diet for 52 weeks, the men also had their blood mixed with prostate tumor cells in a lab experiment, and the blood arrested the growth of the tumor cells. This did not happen with the normal population. Wow! U-tip, supplement yourself. Men should consider taking zinc supplements because men with higher zinc levels seem to have a lower risk of prostate cancer. Try a dose of about 30 milligrams a day. U-tip, know the meds. Prostate conditions can be tougher to treat than lovesickness. It's hard to extinguish the pain. While not full-fledged cures, many medications have been shown to have some levels of success. Your major options include selective alpha-1 blockers. These medicines, like Hytrin and Flomax, control the smooth muscle contraction around the prostate, relaxing the muscles to allow for easier urinary flow from the bladder. About 50% of men who take them see a reduction in prostate-related symptoms, while about 5% experience the side effect of hypotension or low blood pressure. 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. Medicines like Proscar and Avodart shrink prostate cells to reduce prostate volume up to 25% in 1 year, and they reduce PSA by 50%, though they take 6 months to take effect and work only about 1/3 of the time. One rare side effect is decreased libido.
Major ager, nitric oxide, how your levels of this gas can change your health. Inside your body, you have a short-lived gas that tremendously affects your body's function. The gas, called nitric oxide, has a half-life of less than several seconds. Like wind that comes in and blows away pollution, nitric oxide is fleeting and exhilarating. You have nitric oxide, then you don't. So what? We all got gas from time to time. But we're not talking about the gas that clears dinner parties. We're talking about the kind that's important enough to have generated a Nobel Prize in medicine, important enough to influence whether you have a heart attack, and important enough that it powers a man's anatomic cranes. In fact, nitric oxide, NO, was discovered to be the neurotransmitter in the nerve that controls erections. This finding led to the development of Viagra and its friends. And that makes declining functioning of NO over time a key cause of erectile dysfunction and other age-related and arterial-related problems. The bottom line, when it comes to nitric oxide and aging, is this. Nitric oxide plays a fundamental role in keeping a body healthy, and the reverse is also true. In many diseases, the production of nitric oxide is impaired, and that leads to or contributes to cell injury or the dysfunction of organs. Despite its short-lived existence, nitric oxide affects many organs. In the brain, nitric oxide acts as a neurotransmitter to rapidly transmit messages. Much like the way that the brain chemicals serotonin and dopamine promote don't worry, be happy emotions, nitric oxide has a calming effect. Why? Nitric oxide turns on a chain reaction in our cells that allows our blood vessels to relax and dilate. People with atherosclerosis, clogging and hardening of the arteries, commonly don't make enough nitric oxide to keep their arteries open. The lack of NO helps to explain the detrimental effects we feel during periods of high stress as well as periods of low sleep. The common anginal treatment nitroglycerin increases NO, dilating blood vessels and thus decreasing heart pain. Now you should be asking, how do you get your hands on some of this? Nitric oxide is found in the highest levels in the nasopharynx, and that's why nasal breathing and meditation are so important. The flow of air that happens when you breathe through your nose allows very rich sources of nitric oxide to be fuel injected into your system. The NO then helps dilate your arteries so that your blood keeps moving as if it's on an empty country road rather than on an LA freeway. Specifically, here's what we know about NO and how it manifests itself in your body. Stimulating nitric oxide is one of the ways to promote wakefulness. If you're feeling sluggish, it tends to mean that you don't have good levels of NO in those areas of your brain and brainstem that keep you awake. Not having enough nitric oxide promotes aging of the skin, because good circulation is essential for young-looking skin. NO enhances the action of minoxidil, which has been shown to slow hair loss. Sleep apnea inhibits the absorption of nitric oxide into your body. Makes sense, right? When you're overweight, you tend to breathe through your mouth instead of your nose. The theory goes that because of that, you're not sucking those rich sources of nitric oxide into your lungs, so the airways are less dilated and oxygen levels can drop. And that's what might make you fall into one of those cascading cycles where you feel drained, tired, and stressed, which further inhibits your ability to get NO. In fact, NO may soon become one of the clear markers that can help us diagnose and treat conditions before they show more outward symptoms. Research shows that you can see nitric oxide impairment months, maybe even years, before diabetes and atherosclerosis are clinically diagnosed.
Chapter 12, Live in a Sexy Life. You know how the stereotype goes. When you're young and not having sex, you can't think of anything else except sex. When you finally do have sex, you have about as much of an idea about how to have good sex as you have an idea about how to crack safes. And when you finally reach the point where you become a master at sex, if you do say so yourself, you'd rather be knitting blankets than messing around under them. Cruel nature. It's cruel, cruel, cruel nature. You know what? As you age, you should be able to experience the best of what sex has to offer. A deepening of your emotional relationship with the pleasure of your physical relationship. The best part about great sex is that benefits extend far beyond the 84-second ecstasy you may feel at the time. Having monogamous, regular sex has been proven to extend your life. The more you have it for men, and the higher the quality for women, the healthier you are. We, of course, have to acknowledge that there is a biological reality about sex. Sometimes our desire slows down, and sometimes our equipment shuts down. For men, the issue is really an intersection of two major agers, wacky hormones and no nitric oxide. That's because nitric oxide plays a large role in maintaining erections, as does the main male sex hormone, testosterone. For women, nitric oxide doesn't play as large a role in libido and arousal, but some of the most intriguing answers to increasing sexual desire lie in hormones that purport to restore overall vitality and sexual vibrancy. In this chapter, we'll examine not only how a man can deal with his version of menopause, but also whether men and women should consider the so-called miracle hormones that many claim to be the answer to better sex and more energetic lives. What goes up? The anatomy of an erection. Thanks to Viagra and her relatives, which increases the duration of the effect of nitric oxide, erectile dysfunction is no longer an in-the-closet, never-to-be-talked-about disorder. Clinically defined as the consistent inability to attain an erection sufficient for sexual activity, erectile dysfunction, or ED, hits about 50% of men ages 40 to 70, and 70% of men older than 70. We should also note that getting older isn't all bad when it comes to erection issues, since it does mean that for most men, it takes a little longer to ejaculate. Many things can cause the erectile rocket boosters not to fire, including hormone problems, which we'll discuss later in this chapter, trauma to the area, like that caused by poor-fitting bicycle seats, which block off the blood supply to the penis, alcohol, some prescription drugs, and of course, obesity. But the biggest cause of erectile problems is fleeting levels of the major ager nitric oxide due to vascular disease. The way blood flows throughout your body determines your body's ability to maintain and sustain an erection. In fact, erectile disorders are actually precursors to heart problems. So if you or your partner are experiencing erectile problems, it's important to seek treatment to make sure that the next time you're lying down isn't on a surgeon's table. Let's clear up the first misconception about erections. It's not testosterone that's the major driver of erection, though it does play a role. The reality is that erections happen because of many things going on in the body at once. The major way that the penis gets hard is through receptors on cells lining our arteries that stimulate a chain reaction that ultimately relaxes the blood vessels that go to the penis. That reaction is mediated by nitric oxide, that short-lived gas floating around in your body. The aging link? Nitric oxide is usually made by the endothelial cells that line all of our arteries. As soon as even a small amount of hardening of the wall starts with the creation of a mild plaque, levels of nitric oxide plummet, so the vessel can't dilate normally when you need a little extra blood, as when running for the bus or rummaging around in bed. During stimulation, the muscles around the arteries in the penis relax. That relaxation happens so that blood can be absorbed by a spongy structure on the top of the penis called the corpus cavernosum. As the blood rushes in like a tailback breaking for the end zone, the veins in the penis clamp down to keep that blood trapped in the penis, and voila, we've got liftoff, Houston. If those arteries are inflamed and or clogged, then you don't have proper blood flow. And that means you don't have enough nitric oxide to open up your arteries, so you can't get an erection because you can't get blood into your penis. Plus, without an engorged penis, the veins that drain the blood don't kink off, so whatever meager blood enters the organ quickly spills back out. That's why erectile problems, for the most part, aren't manhood problems or mental problems, or you don't do it anymore for me, honey, problems. They're plumbing problems that require you not only to be turned on, but they have the right biological faucets turned on as well. Give me a T, the truth about testosterone. Hear the word testosterone, and we know immediately what you're thinking. You think of muscle, of sex drive, of bravado. It's the vitality hormone that gives men the strength to win a fistfight, and it's the hormone that partly controls how much sex men want and whether or not they're going to experience erectile dysfunction. Most men produce 4 to 7 milligrams of testosterone a day, with the highest blood level in the morning and the lowest level in the evening, which helps to explain why the first thing some men want in the morning is neither coffee nor a shower. Science has yet to explain why the levels rise and fall at these times, but it may be related to the action of the brain's pituitary gland. For practical purposes, those time frames do give some insight into why the so-called nooner can be an effective way to match a couple's sexual urges. Just like women, middle-aged men experience male menopause, or andropause, a decline in sex hormones that affects their quality of life. Testosterone declines as we age. Symptoms include decreased strength, decreased libido, or decreased ability to swing a bat. One of the most outward signs of declining testosterone is a decrease in how often a man has to shave. Slower beard growth equals a drop in male hormones. While the majority of erectile dysfunction cases are caused by vascular issues, about 20% are associated with low testosterone levels. As part of a checkup to determine the root of erectile difficulties, your doc could measure your hormone levels. Though it's a simple blood test, it's unlike most others, because testosterone is not measured directly. To get an accurate assessment of your testosterone levels, you need to have two measurements. One measures the combined level of bound and free testosterone, the active kind that matters in terms of what symptoms you're experiencing in your blood, while the other measures only the testosterone that's bound to proteins. By subtracting the second number from the first, you will find your level of free testosterone. Because free testosterone can bind protein in a test tube and bound testosterone can be displaced, the resulting number will be, at best, a close approximation. It's sort of like trying to get an accurate measurement of spaghetti sauce by weighing the pasta with the sauce, scraping off the sauce, and then weighing the pasta again. Here are some standard free testosterone levels for men your age. Age 20 to 40, free testosterone level is 400 to 1,080. Age 40 to 50, free testosterone level is 350 to 890. Age 50 to 60, the free testosterone level drops to 250 to 750. And above age 70, the free testosterone level is usually between 250 and 650. Now let's make one thing clear. We're not recommending testosterone therapy for men with normal testosterone levels as some kind of anti-aging miracle treatment. Testosterone therapy should be used only for men diagnosed with enough of a deficiency to cause some of the problems we've already outlined. Unfortunately, blood tests are not always accurate enough. Remember, the sauce on the spaghetti is difficult to measure. In the same way, total blood testosterone levels aren't a perfect measure of what's available when you need it. If your doc recommends that you boost your testosterone with supplementation, here's what you need to know about its benefits and potential side effects. In favor, besides improvements in the areas most associated with testosterone, which are libido, muscle mass, and bone strength, testosterone therapy has been shown to decrease levels of lousy or LDL cholesterol and improve insulin sensitivity, so your chances of suffering diabetes decreases. The knock? The main criticism of testosterone therapy has been its reported links to prostate cancer. While there's evidence that the total size of the prostate enlarges in men who take testosterone, there's no clinical evidence that it actually influences prostate function, such as blocking urinary flow so you're up all night visiting the toilet. And there's no strong data to suggest that testosterone therapy is linked at all to prostate cancer, nor is testosterone in general, as evidenced by the fact that 20-year-old men with the highest testosterone levels are at no more risk for developing prostate cancer later in life than men with normal or low levels. The other theoretical concern is heart disease, because men develop the disease earlier than women, but no link has been identified when men take supplements with careful monitoring. Long-term testosterone treatment has also been linked to increased baldness, fluid retention, enlarged breasts, and aggravated sleep apnea. Testosterone is a little like chicken. You can get